This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
I am really thrilled. I'm absolutely delighted at the opportunity to introduce formally Tomas Piketty to you. He's the author of this monumental book, which is sitting right there. An extraordinary phenomenon for us in the Academy, because he's very rapidly become a rock star. I was trying to think of what's the right way to convey that to you. One of them, I thought, he's been on the Colbert Report. And how many of us would just die with, you know, the thought? I mean, that is the mark of distinction, Tomas. Nobel, whether you got a Nobel Prize or not, I don't know. But being on Colbert and all that, that is quite extraordinary. But it is true that he's been on the cover of magazines. His book was reviewed extremely favorably by a couple Nobel Prize winning economists, Paul Krugman and Solow. Paul Krugman and Solow wrote in the New York Review of Books, A Lavish Thing, which is really quite remarkable praise, since the book is quite an extensive critique of Solow's own famous theories of growth. So the amount of praise he's gotten is absolutely extraordinary. The statistics on the sale of the book, you told me it was over 2.2 million. Copies of this book have been sold around the world. That's an extraordinary number for anything at all. But regardez, ladies and gentlemen, look at this. Look at the size of this book, 2.2 million copies of that. And I want to say, I think that the book is really tremendously interesting. I read it when it first came out, and I reread it in preparing for our interview tonight. And I enjoyed it the first time, and I really was tremendously enthusiastic about it again, even the second time. It's so well written and it's so crafted. It's many things. It's not only a discussion of inequality, but in a way it's a history of economic thought. It takes you through the debates over how do we understand growth, how do we understand growth in its manifestations in different ways. It has wonderful references to literature and history. And my advice to people is do buy it. If at various points there's a passage you don't understand, don't get worried. Keep going. Because in a few pages, you'll get onto something that you will understand quite well and you will enjoy, and you'll get a lot out of reading it at the end. I think it's a tremendously rewarding thing to do. And I think that, Tomas, you have changed the debate in economics. And one of the things that you describe in the book is that for many, many years, the field of economics didn't want to talk about distribution, that distribution was sort of a no-no topic, a taboo topic. And I think you've helped just put it back on the stage by saying this is a tremendously important topic, we should be talking about it. And you've asserted it, and I think that what you've done is you've established a tremendously important database which describes the pattern of inequality, and then said to people, I'm giving you some ideas about how to do it. If you don't like it, read through my data and come out with some better interpretations. And that's changed the debate. So what I thought that you and I could do for our 50 minutes is talk about what's the level of inequality that we see in society today? What explains it? Is there an iron law that's driving this? Or how would we explain it? Why does it matter? Why do we care? Is this a disturbing thing or not? And finally, what can we do about it? And then if we have any time, we could also talk about where you make a lot of comments about where research ought to go. This is a research agenda, where you would like it to go. But let's start with the first one. I think you've created this enormous, what I call the elephant in the room, this gigantic database about patterns of inequality. And I wonder if you could help our audience, not all of whom have had time to go through this thing. How would you characterize to our audience what's happened? I see you said there was a run-up end of the 19th century of tremendous inequality, then in the middle of the 20th century, a kind of a flatter period, and now the shocker is that we're running up again to this pattern. So another inequality as extreme as the one that we had up to 1914. So how would you convey that to our audience? What is the best way, in your words, to explain to the audience the fact on the ground of what's happening in inequality?
Okay, so let me first apologize that my English sounds a lot like French, and I hope you will be able to understand me. Let me also stress again, you know, how grateful I am to Arthur Goldhammer, my translator, who, you know, when I read this book in English, you know, I cannot believe that I wrote it myself, because it doesn't look like the kind of English I am able to write. You know, I have a bad English that international economists have, and you know, in particular, talking about the literature in English is something I cannot do properly, which I can do more or less in French. But without a translator like Art, the book would not be, I think, as good as it is, thanks to Art in its English version. Let me also stress that in this book, I try to put the study of distribution back at the center of economic thinking and back at the center of historical research in a way. But this is something I could never have done without very large international teams of researchers with whom I have been very fortunate to work during these past 15 years. Many of them are actually based in California. So let me stress, you know, Emmanuel Saez at Berkeley, Jean-Laurent Rosenthal at Caltech, and now Gabriel Zucman, who's also at Berkeley with Emmanuel. But there are also researchers from India, Abhijit Banerjee from Argentina, Facundo Alvaredo from China, Nancy Chian. So this has become a very large project. What we've done, in a way, is very simple, is to extend at a much broader scale a work that was first started by Kuznets in the 1950s. So Kuznets was a U.S. economist, well, Ukrainian-born, but U.S. economist, who computed the first series for GDP and national income for the U.S. For the interwar period. And his next big task in the early 1950s was to use data from the federal income tax, which had been created in 1913 in the U.S., in order to study the evolution of the share of national income going to the top 10% of the distribution, the share going to the bottom 90%. And he came with a very good news in the 1950s, coming back to your question about what we have found. Well, what Kuznets in the 1950s found was a very good news, which was a decline in inequality, in particular in the U.S. Well, in fact, the U.S. was the only country for which he had data to begin with a strong decline of inequality between 1913 and 1948, with the share of national income going to the top 10% declined from almost 50% of total income at the beginning of the period to 30-35%, so say from one-half to one-third over this time period. And this finding, it was only for one country for 35 years, but this was the first time ever there was an historical inequality series. So people had been talking about inequality forever in the 19th century, Ricardo, Marx, some of them had very good insight, but they had no data, basically, which puts limitation on what you can say, or actually sometimes it puts no limit on what you can say, which is a problem. So even if the data that Kuznets had is not perfect, you know, it's better than no data at all. And all what we've done, in a way, with Emmanuel Saez and dozens of co-authors, is to extend this work to many more years, many more countries. This had not been done before, I think, mostly for bad reason. I think this historical data was viewed as too historical for economists, who tend to care only about the past 10 years or 10 months and viewed this long-run perspective as not useful for them. And also, this was viewed as maybe too economic for historians. So historians were not using the data either. So nobody was really using the data. To be honest, one reason why it was not done before is that it's also much easier today with modern information technologies to collect this data at a broad scale. And you know, Kuznets was doing everything by hand, and it was... So we've been very fortunate to be able to do that. Now, having many more years and many more countries gives us a very different perspective than the one of Kuznets. So Kuznets himself was very cautious with the interpretation of the decline in inequality that he found for the U.S. But starting in the 1950s, 60s, during the Cold War period, there was this very optimistic interpretation of the Kuznets finding known as the Kuznets curve, according to which in advanced stages of development, you have a natural decline in inequality and concentration of income. Now, when we take a longer run perspective, we see that there's really nothing natural in this evolution. Well, I think, you know, there's never anything natural in economic evolution. They always depend on the man-made institutions and legal system. But particularly in the period between 1913 and 1948, you had huge political shocks due to the war, due to the Great Depression, the New Deal, change in policy, rise of progressive taxation, sharp sharp compression of the wage distribution, in particular in the U.S. during World War II, and clearly this was a big part of the story. And when we take a longer run perspective, what we see also and what we found with Emmanuel Saez is a huge rise of inequality in the U.S. starting around 1980. Partly due to a change in policy after the Reagan Revolution, so that at the end of the period, inequality today is sort of back to the initial level in the case of the US, which is roughly half of total income to the top 10% instead of one-third during the 50s, 60s, 70s, which is an enormous transformation. Now, in different countries, we see different evolution. You know, there's nothing universal in this pattern. I guess the general conclusion that emerges from this set of countries that we have looked at, and we have now over 40 countries, not only in North America, Europe, Japan, but also more and more in emerging countries and developing countries, the general lesson is that the history of income and wealth inequality is not simply and not mainly an economic history. This is really a political, cultural, social history. This is why also in the book I talk about representations of inequality and belief system in political debate, also in the literature, because I think ultimately these representations of inequality drive changes in institutions, in policies, and this is what determines change in inequality. So to be a bit more concrete, one of the most striking findings is that it's really the decline of income inequality that took place during the first half of the 20th century in the U.S., but also in Europe, and in a way even more so in Europe than in the U.S., is not the outcome of market forces or a natural economic process, whatever it means. It's really the consequences of a sharp change in views of the market system and a sharp change in the regimes of economic policy in very different areas, labor market policy, education, progressive taxation, nationalization, rent control. You know, there's a whole set of policy, corporate governance, that have changed over this period, partly as a reaction to the large political shocks. So one of the striking findings is that up until 1914, there is a very strong resistance by the elite against tax reform, against social reform. In particular, I am very much influenced not only by our findings for the U.S. but by the findings in my home country in France. You know, with France sometimes likes to portray itself as a country based on equality. But in fact, there's a lot of hypocrisy in France and also in the U.S. about equality and meritocracy and equal opportunity. We know we like all these big discourse, but as a matter of fact, France was the very last country in 1914 to create an income tax in the summer of 1914, in July of 1914. And this was not to invest in schools or education. This was to pay for the war, to go to war with Germany. And until the summer of 1914, what's interesting is that the French elite, the French political, financial, economic, political elite, was basically saying, okay, we have done the French Revolution, so that's enough, basically. We are a country of equals because, you know, we don't have aristocrats like in Britain. So, you know, they would need progressive taxation of income and wealth. But we have done the French Revolution. Everybody is equal under the law of property. Everybody can become rich by, you know, competing on the market. So we don't need progressive taxation. And you know, what's quite striking about this hypocrisy is that when we look at the data that we have, in fact, the level of concentration of wealth that you have in France in 1914 is as large as in Britain. It's extremely large. And probably because, you know, being a republic rather than a monarchy, I'm very happy to be in a republic, but I don't think this really changes the dynamics of wealth concentration all that much. In 1914, landed estates do not matter really anymore. What we're talking about is, new forms of foreign investment, financial assets, business assets, and the dynamics of concentration of wealth that take place during the 19th century up until 1914 have nothing to do with the formal nature of the political regime in France and Britain. So the general lesson I draw from this is that elites always have a lot of imagination, you know, to justify inequality and to justify their situation. And this was true, you know, in France or in Europe up until 1914. And it was only these very large political shocks induced by World War I, World War II, the Bolshevik Revolution, the Great Depression, which in the end made the elites accept a number of reforms, fiscal, social reforms that they didn't want to accept before. And I think this is a lesson that's important for today, because today we also see sometimes a lot of hypocrisy, including in this country, but not only, about inequality and about you know, equal opportunity, meritocracy, etc., which sometimes is really not at all in line with what we see in the data. So if we want to, you know, adopt a better you know, response and policy strategies in the future, I think it's important to take stock of this historical record and learn from this broad set of historical experience that I described.
So what's the most striking to you? Well, there's a lot of language out there. We hear about the 0.1%, the 1%, the top 5%, the 10%, but we also hear a lot about the lower half of the population, that wages have been stagnant for half the population. And these seem very different. And I wonder which of these, when you say that income inequality, that inequality is rising, which of these different meanings of that is the most striking and important to you?
So in my book, I try to describe, you know, the basic description of society that I give is I distinguish between the bottom half of the population, the top 10%, and then the middle 40%, which I sometimes call the middle class. Now, the distribution is not the same whether you look at income, labor income, or whether you look at wealth, or whether you look at the combination of the two, which is total income, the sum of labor and capital income. If we look at the distribution of total income, you know, what the orders of magnitude I think to have in mind, which are quite striking, is that the share going to the top 10%, as I said, has changed between 50%, around 50% at the beginning of the century, the previous century, of the 20th century in the US, down to 30-35% in the 50s, 60s, 70s, where it was until 1980, and now it's closer to 50%. Now, if we compare to the share going to the bottom 50%, so the bottom 50%, you know, would get hardly 15%, 20% of income. So whether the top is getting, you know, 35 or 50, or up to, you know, there are some countries in the world where it can be even more than that. You know, in Brazil, you are close to 60%. In South Africa, you are close to 65%. So the concrete difference it makes is that whether you have 30-35% of total income for the top 10 or 60-65, basically means that what's left for the bottom 90% is you know, twice as small, say, in South Africa than in Europe, for a total given level of GDP. So the bottom line is that distribution can make a huge difference for the actual life of people and the purchasing power and kind of type of life that you can have. So, you know, when you have a stable share and when it's not too large for the top, in a way, all you care about is increasing the size of the pie and increasing growth. So take in the US in the 50s, or 60s, or 70s, when you have a stable share of about one-third of total income going to the top 10, it also means that everybody benefits from growth in the same proportion. So like in 1950, 1960, if you have 2% or 3% GDP growth, with a stable share going to the top means that everybody is growing at 2 or 3%. Average income of the top 10 is growing at 2 or 3%. Average income of the bottom 90. So in a way, you don't care so much about inequality. You have some rich people, poor people, middle class, but everybody is going up at the same speed. It's very different. It has been very different since 1980, when the top share goes from 30-35 to 50%. A very concrete consequence is that about two-thirds of total U.S. economic growth over this period was, in effect, absorbed by the top 10%. So if the total growth rate in the U.S. economy had been very high, you know, like China, you know, 8% per year, you know, after all, even if you get two-thirds for the top, you still have some growth left for the bottom. But this was not the situation. You know, you have rising inequality everywhere except in the growth statistics. And so the per capita growth in the US over this period was closer to 1.5% per year. So if you have two-thirds of that going to the top 10, you know, you have basically zero left for the, or very small left for the rest of the population. So many people, I think, now agree that this has contributed not only to the stagnation of median household income and bottom 50% household income in this country, but probably also to the rise of household debt in order to compensate for this loss of income or at least relative income position. But maybe this has probably also contributed to fragilize the financial system and eventually to the 2008 crisis. So we're talking about big numbers here. You know, so that's why it's important to look not only at the top 0.01 or, you know, I think looking at the top 10%, you know, this is a sufficiently large group that, you know, when you have a change in their share of total income from 35 to 50%, that's a huge transformation in the structure of the economy. And that's an enormous domestic imbalance, if you want. You know, another comparison maybe that can be meaningful is with what sometimes people call international imbalance. You know, after the 2008 financial crisis, many people wanted to find explanation, you know, elsewhere, you know, to blame others. So usually we like to blame China, for instance, or you know, in France we like to blame Germany. You know, you always have people to blame. So the idea was, well, because these countries have very large trade surplus, this is creating a lot of international imbalance. You have all this extra saving in the international financial system. They don't know what to do with it. This has fragilized the financial system. I'm not saying this is not important. I'm just saying it's important to realize that the trade deficit, as even when it was very large, was 3, 4% of GDP. Now, the transfer in income between the bottom 90% and the top 10% in the US was 15% of national income, so 3-4 times bigger than this trade deficit. So in other words, the domestic imbalance was much bigger than the international imbalance. So if we want to find you know, reasons for the financial crisis, I think they are right there in America. We don't need to find them on the other side of the world.
I wonder if you could talk about a little bit more. One of the things that's tremendously enjoyable in the book is your use of literature, of Balzac and Jane Austen. You kind of give the economics behind things that I noticed but never knew the economics behind them. I remember being very struck in Jane Austen that Mrs. Bennet is excited because Darcy makes £5,000 a year. And I thought, how curious, you know, that she doesn't talk. Today, we would talk about how much money Bill Gates has. We wouldn't talk about his income. But in those novels, they would always express it in terms of the income. And you explain why that would be the case. It would require a stable economy where income was predictable. That's what you needed to know. That explained the assets. So I thought, oh, wow, finally, after all these years, I understand why these are like that. But I was trying to think, well, what's the modern equivalent of this? And I was thinking that we hear a tremendous amount about the income of the very, very top. And you talk about that, and you just alluded to it. And I wonder how important you think that is, because you suggested that these extraordinary salaries that are made in some financial institutions is possibly destabilizing, that may have contributed to the financial crisis. But I wonder, do you think that is important? Is that something we should worry about, or does that seem not so terribly important? There's a lot of talk about the 0.1% or the 1%. And is that something, do you think that's a misguided concern? And I have a pusher question. I mean, in a way, what's the matter with that? I could imagine somebody saying, well, look, those people work very hard. Why should we be worried about what they make? Are they the deserving? There's a debate we hear a lot about the undeserving poor. There's also a debate about the deserving rich, or is there an undeserving rich? No, seriously, because your chapter 9 actually questions whether, in fact, these very top salaries have an economic justification. So I think you're suggesting that these are undeserving. I'd like you to talk about that. Is that an important thing? Because you're implying that they're it's not only undeserving, they've contributed to the financial crises that we've had. So on those low temperature, low volatility, uncontroversial topics, what are your thoughts?
Well, first, you know, let me say very clearly that we still know too little about inequality. You know, we know a little bit more than we used to. And I'm trying, you know, in this book to share this knowledge and to you know, so that everybody can draw their own conclusion from this body of data. But certainly we know too little. So inequality, you know, is a fight and will always be a fight because you have different interests, but also you have different belief system and representation of the world. And what I find interesting in the debate about inequality is that, you know, the people at the top, they always try to justify their positions through a complex belief system in order to convince that this is in the interest of the poor. You know, you never find people at the top who will say, well, okay, you know, I'm very rich, they are very poor, you know, too bad for them. They would always say, you know, it's, yes, I'm very rich, but this is in the interest of the poor. And in fact, this brings more growth, more innovation. And this I find very interesting because, you know, of course, sometimes it's right, sometimes it's wrong, and, you know, you have strong self-serving statements, but at least this shows that there's a common ground in the sense that people want to justify inequality in terms of the common interest. And this belief system, I try in the book, you know, in the book, I'm not giving a mathematical formula, you know, saying, okay, this is exactly the point where inequality becomes excessive and this is the point where it is acceptable. Because there will always be a lot of uncertainty about this tipping point. All we can do is to try to put these different statements under public scrutiny and see what stands and what does not stand. So let me give some example of what I think I have learned from this data, but, you know, these are just my own interpretation of the evidence. Let me also say, as you refer to the literature, saying that, you know, I think we social scientists, you know, I view myself more as a social scientist than as an economist. You know, I think, you know, the view that economists have built their own economic science, which is distinct from the rest of the social sciences, you know, I think is just wrong. And it's, you know, I think many people, you know, one reason for the success of this book is that many people are tired to hear that this is too complicated for them, that issues of income and wealth should be left to a small group of experts who have built a science that is so sophisticated that the rest of the world cannot understand. You know, I think this is a big joke. This is wrong. You know, I view my work more as the work of an historian than an economist in a way. I think these frontiers between disciplines are not so clear. I also think that if we take the social sciences as a whole, you know, we the kind of language and concept we develop in order to answer to this kind of issue and statistical construction and the kind of analytical, historical narratives that I try to develop in this book, you know, I think this is useful, but this is certainly not more useful than what we can learn about inequality in the literature. You know, I think the literature has its own unique, powerful way to talk about the consequences of money in the life of people. You know, when Jane Austen or Balzac tells you the consequence of this 5,000 pounds income or 10,000 francs income for the life of people, who you're going to meet, who you're going to marry with, this is incredibly powerful. And this is the same today. You know, you read Carlos Fuentes about capitalism in Mexico. You know, you will learn a lot more than by looking at the statistical series in Mexico. I think we have to be modest about what we can learn from them. Still, I want to answer your question very quickly. What can we learn about the acceptable level of inequality? So let me take two examples. One example, you know, is it useful to pay top managers the banking sector or in non-financial corporation, you know, $10 million per year instead of $1 million? Is it useful in terms of job creation, better performance? I could not find any evidence for this in the data we've used. You know, in the data we've put together, you know, I don't see any justification for this kind of compensation package based on incentives or performance. You know, of course, you need to pay managers well. You know, I'm not saying they should all be paid average wage. Maybe you need to pay them, you know, 10 times average wage. You know, you can discuss, but paying them 100 times or 200 times average wage, you know, the view that we need to pay them that much, otherwise, you know, nobody will accept to work as a productive manager. It's just pure ideology. It's crazy. And in the data we have, you know, we don't see that. So with Emmanuel Saez, Stephanie Stancheva, we have put together a database where we have the compensation of managers in all publicly traded corporations in North America, Europe, Japan. You compare corporations, those who pay their managers 10 million, rather 1 million. Do you have more job creation? No, you don't. So what explains the difference in top managerial pay over time across countries? Well, I think it's more institutions. And, you know, you've worked a lot on corporate governance. And I think these institutions are important. I think change also in the tax system, in the progressive of the tax system, has completely changed incentives for top managers to try to bargain very aggressively, particularly in the U.S., in order to put the right people in the right compensation committee in order to get another million or another 10 million. But that's very difficult to justify in terms of incentives, productivity, at least not in the data we have. Now, you know, if someone finds other data, you know, we can look at it. But at this stage, I think this level of inequality is just not useful. It's not in the common interest. Another example about the concentration of wealth. I think one of the lessons I draw from history is that the extreme concentration of wealth that we had in pretty much every European country up until 1914 was not useful for growth. So you had over 90% of total wealth to the top 10%, including 60-70% of wealth to the top 1%. This was reduced tremendously by the World War, by the new policy regimes that came after the war. So there was much less inequality in 1950s and in 1910. Was this bad for growth? Certainly not. I think if anything, it increased mobility. The problem with extreme inequality is that it tends to come together with large perpetuation of inequality over time, lack of mobility. And I think this is the same problem today when you have excessive inequality. So, to make it clear, inequality is not a problem in itself. You know, I'm certainly not saying we want complete equality. I'm just saying that extreme inequality is very difficult to justify on the basis of the common interest. And where does it start? Again, there's no perfect mathematical formula, but on the basis of historical evidence, I think it's very, you know, making the claim that today in the U.S., we cannot give more to the bottom 50% because otherwise, people at the top will not have enough incentives to work hard, and that's not, you know, I think is just crazy. You know, it mm-hmm. makes no sense at all from the kind of data we.
It's an election year, isn't it? Say more about the comparison. I think that's very instructive. I mean, I spend my time, I work on foreign countries, I work on comparative economy, but I don't think most people have time for it. Listening and reading through, I think the comparisons you make are tremendously important because we have a lot of discussion about American data, but you do a lot comparing to other countries. And say something about the patterns of what are the differences between that you find in income distribution and these pay situations between, I think you characterize the Anglo-Saxons, the French like to call us the Anglo-Saxons. So I mean the UK, Canada, and the US versus continental countries in Japan. Tell the audience something about what differences you observe on these data points.
Well, I will more contrast the U.S. with Europe because, well, you know, Britain is somewhere between Europe and the U.S., but I think it's closer to Europe, not only in terms of geography, but also in terms of the basic social structure and evolution of inequality. So if we take Europe as a whole, you know, Germany, France, Britain, Italy, what's striking when you make the comparison with the U.S. is that you have a reversal in inequality over the past century. So Europe used to have more inequality than the U.S. Until World War I, you know, with higher concentration of property in Europe. higher inequality of income in Europe than in the US. And today it's the opposite. You have much more inequality in the US than Europe. Now that's interesting because it shows that, you know, institutions make a difference and political history make a difference. So it's not, you don't have deterministic forces which make some countries more, tolerant to inequality forever or more prone to inequality forever. You know, this can change over time. For a long time, the US was relatively egalitarian as compared to Europe, and was part of the U.S. identity was based on this feeling of equality, not only equal opportunity, but less concentration of wealth and property. And it's very striking that the I quote in my book, you have this famous discourse by Irving Fisher, who was president of the American Economic Association and was giving this big speech to in 1919 to his fellow economists. Irving Fisher was not at all an extreme left-wing person. You know, he was, if anything, more a bit to the right or center. And he came with this big speech saying, you know, my fellow American economists, there's a big danger in our country that we are becoming too unequal. And if we continue like this, you know, we will be as unequal as Europe. And so today we already have about 50% of the wealth for the top 2%. And there had been a study trying to compute that a bit before. And, you know, in Europe, that's even worse. They have 50% of the wealth for the top 1%. But, you know, we don't want to go in this direction because this will be an undemocratic distribution of wealth that is not compatible with the American spirit. And then he came with a solution, which was, well, you know, I have thought very hard about the problem. And I think what we should do is to tax inheritance very heavily. And what I propose is to tax, to take 1/3 of inheritance at the first generation, 2/3 after 2 generations, and all of it after 3 generations that you transmit the wealth. And this is about what the US did, actually. You know, in the inheritance tax that was created and developed in the 1920s, 1930s, involve a top inheritance tax rate of 70, 80% on very large inheritance. So it was not the 100% after 3 generations that Irving Fisher was proposing, but you know, it was close to it. And for the income tax system, you also see that the US had, you know, the most progressive income tax system for a very long time. If you take between 1930 and 1980, on average, the top marginal income tax rate in the US was 82%. So sometimes it was 91 under Roosevelt, sometimes it was 70, but if you make the average, it was 82%. Now in Europe, you don't see any country who has such a high top tax rate over this period. You know, you see 50, you see 60, you don't see 82% for half a century. And apparently this did not destroy American capitalism. Probably because this very top tax rate applied to very, very high income, typically above $1 million in annual income, if we take dollars of today. And, well, maybe, you know, apparently it's not so useful to pay people more than that, and that's probably the reason why this did not destroy American capitalism. And if anything, the productivity growth rates were higher in the 50s, 60s, 70s than that what they have been since Reagan. So since Reagan years, you have a complete change in policy. And so that's part of the reason why inequality is much higher today in the US than in Europe. So coming back to the comparison with Europe for the recent period, you know, what's striking is that the very large rise in inequality that you see in the US, you don't really see it in Europe or in Japan. You see an increase in the share of total income going to the top, which means that top incomes have benefited a bit more from globalization than the average. But the gap with the average growth is much less strong than in the US. Now, that's interesting in itself because this means that you cannot explain rising inequality just by invoking globalization and, you know, the fact that China entered the world labor market and that this has pushed pressure on low wage and middle wage in developed countries. I'm not saying that's not important. I think the China and globalization, you know, that's part of the story. But if this was the only story, then, you know, you should see the same rise in inequality everywhere because globalization happened not only in the US. It also happened in Sweden, in Germany, in Japan, in France. And you don't see the same rise in inequality. So I think one of the lessons from this if you dig more into the data, is that different policies can make a difference. So, probably the very unequal access to education, in particular to higher education in the US as compared to Europe, played a role. So if you have more unequal access to skills, that can contribute. Differences in labor market policies, big fall in union, but also in the relative value of the minimum wage in the US over this period as compared to Europe. Transformation of corporate governance, the tax progressivity. I think the unequal education part is probably one of the most important part of the explanation. And I would like to mention on this a very interesting research by Emmanuel Saez, Raj Shetty, and other researchers in their team, where they were able to link data on parental income taken from income tax return to the students, to their children, whether they go to college or not. And they have an absolutely fascinating graph for the US for the current situation today, where you see, if you plot the percentile of the parental distribution of income on the horizontal axis and the probability that you go to college for the children on the vertical axis, you get a straight line that is almost the first diagonal. So you go almost from 0% chance to go to university when your parents are in the bottom 10% to 100%. Well, it's not quite from 0 to 100. When your parents are very poor, you have a 20% chance to make it, and when your parents are very rich, you have only a 90% chance to make it. But basically, you have a straight line going from 20 to 90%. And, on the top of that, when you are on the top of the distribution, of course, you don't go to the same university or colleges than people at the top when they go. So, this is a kind of evidence, I think, which is very striking because there's a lot of hypocrisy about meritocracy and equal opportunity. Every country, the US, certainly France also, likes to portray itself as based on fair opportunities for all. But then, when you look at this kind of data, the gap between the official discourse and the reality is really enormous, and it's really striking. So I think we have to put these claims about meritocracy, equal opportunity under strong public scrutiny. That's why transparency and access to this kind of data is very important, and I think it's very important to put it on the public table and in order to try to confront this. And these differences in policy, in the end, explain why different countries are able to help a bigger part of their population to benefit from globalization and economic growth.
So I'm sure you're getting a lot. Let's talk about solutions. You've been suggesting several. I mean, you're getting a lot of phone calls from political figures all over the place asking you for advice. What are you telling them? What are the solutions to these problems? If we really take seriously that inequality is a bad thing, what should we do about it?
Well, let me first say that, I am a polite person, so when a politician asks me to talk, I usually accept. Well, it depends which politician, but usually I am not too optimistic about, how useful this kind of private conversation with politicians can be. I think in the end, political change comes from public democratic discussion and from the pressures and all of us are able to put on the political process. I think in the end, very often, political leaders are just doing what the dominant public opinion is asking them to do, or what they feel the dominant public opinion is asking them to do. So to me, it's much more important to try to move the dominant public opinion than to talk to politicians. So if politicians read books, then I think that's very good for them, and that's very good for us also. But it's... So, what I tell them is the same thing than what I try to describe in this book, which is that, you know, there's no magic bullet to reduce inequalities. There's a whole set of policies that are important. So we don't, you know, sometimes people would like us to choose between either you want to emphasize education and skills or progressive taxations or unions or corporate governance. But, you know, I think all of these are important. And it's really a combination. If you want to explain the differences between countries, and if you want to explain, it's really a combination of proper education policies with broad access to high quality education, and so you really need to make sure that you have good data on who is accessing what kind of schools and universities. You want a labor market policy. I think, you know, especially with the decline of unions pretty much everywhere, you need, you know, national minimum wages can play an important role. So, of course, you need to put them at the right level. But if you take a country like the U.S. right now, the federal minimum wage is at a level in terms of purchasing power that is less than what it was in the 1960s, which is really quite unusual in a country to see an absolute decline in the, you know, right now it's like $7.2 or $7.3 per hour. It was in dollars of 2015, it was over $10 per hour in the 1960s. So when Obama proposed to increase it to $10, it would just be back to the 1960s, which is a good start. But it's quite striking to see that. So I think this kind of policy, you know, putting the minimum wage in line with the general growth of the economy is important. Now, of course, that's not enough. If you want to keep increasing bottom wages, you also have at the same time to invest in skills and education so that people can access high productivity jobs. So that's why you want to do all of these policies together. I talk about progressive taxation. I in the book, I emphasize the difference and the complementarity between progressive taxation of income and progressive taxation of property, of wealth. I think both are important, and every tax system in history is trying to achieve some balance between the taxation of the flow of income and the taxation of the stock of property. Now, you already have wealth tax or property tax everywhere, in particular in the US, the property tax is a very big tax by international standards. It just happens to be not progressive. So you everybody is paying basically in proportion to the value of your house, and it's not progressive, and it's not taking into account the financial wealth, financial assets, financial liabilities. So that you can have very very low net wealth, or, you know, just to take an example, you know, if you take a middle class or a lower middle class family in the US who they own a house that's worth you know, $400,000 or $300,000, but if they have a mortgage that is you know, $380,000, you know, they are not very rich. Their net wealth is very small, or it could even be negative if the real estate value has fallen below the mortgage, and still they keep paying the same property tax as a family that would have the same house but no mortgage and 1 million or 2 million in financial assets. Now, I think this makes very little sense. You know, it's very difficult to find an economic rationale for not taking into account net wealth as a basis of for contribution and just taking into account the gross value of real estate property. The only reason why we have this kind of tax system is that it was created at a time, basically 200 years ago in the US, but also in France, the property tax has not been changed for the past 200 years, at a time when real estate and land was the main form of wealth, and you had very little financial wealth and financial debt. And this is why it was created this way. Now, the problem is that it has not changed at all. And so I think, you know, all I am saying is, well, you know, maybe we should try to adapt this to the 21st century and make it a tax on comprehensive net wealth, starting from where we are, from the kind of property tax that we have. But, you know, I'm not saying this will be the magic bullet to fight inequality. I think, again, it's a combination between progressive taxation, education, you know, healthcare, social system, social welfare, minimum wage, Corporate governance also is very important, and you know, co-determination, involvement of workers in companies, I think is an area of policy which I touch upon a little bit in my book when I talk about German capitalism and stakeholder models. Probably not enough, but I think that's very important. You know, in Sweden, you have 1/3 of the board members in company who are representative of the workers. In Germany, you have 1/2, and you know, apparently this is you know, this is not bad. This is working. And you know, for a long time in my country, in France, you know, employers and capitalists were saying, "Oh no, that's not possible. You know, you don't want a worker with a vote." So they can be there to sit and see what's happening in the board, but not with a real vote, you know, because they will do very stupid things. And then at some point, people told, you know, the French shareholders, but look, this is what they're doing in Germany, in Sweden, and apparently, you know, they are doing better than French firms. So, you know, what are you saying? And so last year, actually 2 years ago, there was a new law in France saying, okay, the bosses finally accepted that there will be one vote for a worker representative out of 12 board members. So, you know, it's not Sweden and Germany, but still it used to be zero. It had always been zero. Just like in the US or in Britain, where it's still zero. But I think that's an interesting issue for discussion. That's you know, the governance structure of companies, but also, you know, in other sectors, you know, you want to invent new form of participatory governance and in order to share the power. You know, capital and ownership is about power. It's about and so there are different policies that I think are very much complementary in order to get to a more balanced distribution of power in society. And progressive taxation is one of these policies, but there are many other policies that are also important, and in a way even more important, that have to do in particular with the organization of decision-making power in companies, in foundations, in media organization, you know, and these are issues for the future with crowdfunding and new forms of participatory finance. There are many discussions about this which we will have in the future that we didn't have before. So, you know, the fact that public property in the standard form of state property was a gigantic historical failure in the communist countries, you know, doesn't mean that the discussion about property is over. You know, I think the view that the shareholder company with all power to shareholders is the only way to organize economic activity and property is just wrong. You know, there are many intermediate ways between the shareholder company and state property that still need to be invented, both in the sort of traditional manufacturing sector like German firms or Swedish firms, but also in new sectors, in higher education, in health sectors, in organization, in the media sector, and you know, all of these issues are not addressed as much as they should in the book. They are addressed a little bit, but
it's not long enough.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, you know, I have to write other books. You know, I'm sorry. Yes, this is just an introduction. Yes.
So you've written a book that talks. It's about. It's called Capital. So it's about the nature of capital. But it's the big headline theme has to do with inequality. And I wonder if you could tell us, what is it about inequality that bothers you? Why is inequality bad? Is inequality bad, and why do you think it is?
No, let me make very clear. Inequality is not bad in itself. You know, the problem is with extreme inequality. Now, when does inequality become extreme? Well, that's the difficult part, and all what we have is a set of historical experience from which we can all make our mind about this difficult question. You know, there's nothing that bothers me particularly about inequality. I think everybody is bothered about inequality in the sense that in all modern democratic societies, we want to give justification for inequality. So as I was saying before, you know, even the very rich people, they will always try to find some justification that it is in the interest of the poor. And as long as inequality is in the interest of the poor, you know, I have no problem indeed with inequality. The difficult question is when exactly does inequality cease to be the interest in the common interest of the poor? And so this is a big question that you have in all modern societies. And I don't think my way of at looking at the problem is any different from everybody has. You know, all what's different is that I'm very fortunate to be paid to do research and to collect historical data, and so this is what made me able to, write this book and collect this data. But it's in itself there's no, as I said, there's extreme inequality is not in the interest of the poor anymore. Tends to be bad for growth because it leads to very high perpetuation of inequality. So very high concentration of wealth than what we had in Europe until 1914. I don't think we want to return there. The other problem with that kind of very high inequality is that it tends to lead to a lot of tension and political and social tension and sometimes political instability. And I think the rise of nationalism in pre-World War I Europe had something to do with the extreme internal social tensions of European societies. When you don't know how to address in a peaceful manner your domestic social problems, it's always tempting to try to blame others. You can blame other countries, you can blame China, you can blame Germany, you can always find countries to blame for your problems, or you can blame foreign workers. That's a problem certainly in my country right now in France, where we're going to have regional elections in December, and it's possible that the extreme right wing party wins one or two or three regions, given the electoral system for regional elections. And that's a problem in other European countries. So when you don't manage to address inequality properly, it's always tempting to find other people to blame. In the U.S. also, the politics of hate and the politics of political polarization can also be a consequence of inequality. And instead of trying to address the problem, you try to put different groups of with different ethnic origin or cultural origins against each other, and racism can be, the equivalent of nationalism in Europe in many ways as a sort of strategy not to address inequality. So this is what makes me concerned about inequality, is that if you are not able to deal with inequality in a democratic, peaceful manner through democratic institutions, through transparency, then there will be other people that will deal with inequality in their own way. And that can be very dangerous. And this has been very dangerous historically with the rise of nationalism and extreme right-wing movement in Europe in particular. And I'm very concerned about this.
Thank you, Thomas.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.